Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could human activity be responsible for antibiotics losing their life-saving power? Doctors have long tried to help patients understand the importance of taking these drugs correctly to clear up infections in order to avoid helping pathogens mutate into drug-resistant strains. But that is happening anyway, in part because of the widespread practice of dosing livestock animals with antibiotics, whether or not they are sick. The drugs can help pigs, cows, and chickens grow faster. But as my guest today discovered, they may also be cultivating strains of superbugs that are resistant or even impervious to all known antibiotics and can infect humans as well as animals. Journalist David Hoffman is a correspondent for Frontline. A new episode titled The Trouble with Antibiotics airs tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What is antibiotic resistance exactly, and how does it happen?
You know, antibiotics are actually a pretty modern phenomenon. They were invented in the 30s and came into widespread use in the 50s. They were miracle drugs. They made possible a lot of modern transplant surgeries. They're life-saving. They've saved millions of lives. But in the end, the ability of Mother Nature to overcome something like these miracle drugs is relentless. Bacteria are constantly trying to figure out how to survive. It's the process of evolution that goes on every second of every day. And what's happened is that some of the bacteria have figured out how to evade and avoid and destroy these antibiotics that we invented. And that's called resistance. It's important for all of us because we get a scrape, an infection, or somebody in our family is hospitalized. We look to these drugs actually to help us preserve their health, to help them get rid of the infection. And if somebody goes to the hospital or even to the doctor with an infection that can't be treated, if the doctor turned to you and said, "I'm out of options," well, that's happening with increasing frequency, and that's the worry.
And once those bacteria have grown resistant, we can try stronger and stronger antibiotics, but they don't always work.
And for a long time, especially through the 60s and the early 70s, we had a plentiful supply. A lot of new antibiotics were being discovered, and people thought, look, if the old ones aren't working, at least some of these new ones will work. But we've reached a point where the pipeline of new antibiotics is drying up, where there are fewer and fewer new ones. And at the same time, the bacteria are learning how to evade and avoid them. And we have a kind of a collision here where things have gotten much worse in recent years.
So this resistance is part of the reason that our doctors will say, even after your strep throat starts to feel better, you need to finish the entire course. A lot of people have heard this and understand why. But it's not only use and misuse among the human population that contributes to this problem. I have to tell you, I had no idea that the lion's share of antibiotics sold in this country are used on animals.
By most estimates, the 70% of the antibiotics sold go to farm animals. Now, those animals, in many cases, are bigger than we are. Their metabolism's different. There are different ways in which you can measure that. But a lot of antibiotics are going into the agricultural field, and that's the subject of our program.
So how did the industrialization of farming amplify the potential for disease transmission among livestock?
Well, this all goes back to this post-war desire after World War II in American society for more meat and cheaper meat and chicken. So a lot of farming changed after World War II and became much more large scale. And this wasn't, you know, just something somebody thought up. This was in response to our demand, right? We wanted to have steaks and barbecue chicken, and we wanted more of it. And so this forced a lot of, I shouldn't say forced, but at least brought a lot of farmers to the conclusion they needed to have more animals and closer together. And industrial farming in that time turned out to be animals being raised in more confined circumstances, which allowed disease to spread more quickly.
In the same way that it does in army barracks and schools and prisons.
Yeah, it's a biological fact that some of these bacteria are easily spread and can infect, jump from the environment or one animal to another. You can just imagine when you bring a large number of animals in a confined space.
So in the 1940s, David, farmers began experimenting with giving their animals antibiotics. At what point did scientists begin to suspect there might be a link between antibiotic use in livestock and outbreaks of human illness?
Well, the first thing I would say is that some cases, some of the antibiotic use in animals was not the result of a scientist having an aha moment saying, aha, this will work. Some of it was actually quite accidental or a byproduct of developing other kinds of medicines for animals, that they noticed that animals that were healthy but were routinely given small doses of antibiotics grew larger and on less feed. And that was an important economic factor for everybody in agriculture. Now, this happened at the time, especially in the 50s, when antibiotics were being created rapidly for human health, and it seemed like the sky was the limit. In the early 60s, scientists began to notice the problem of resistance really coming to the fore. But again, since new antibiotics were being developed, it wasn't as urgent, right? All right, this particular antibiotic ceased being effective in half the cases that show up. Well, we'll use this new one. It'll be stronger. The sky was always the limit. It wasn't until recent years that we began to feel the pinch, when no longer did we always have this flow, and we had the problem of resistance expanding. And, you know, don't take my word for it. This is the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology said recently, we are now at dire risk, that was their word, dire risk of losing the progress we made with antibiotics.
And there is evidence now that farms are becoming sources themselves of resistant bacteria. Let's listen to what you heard from Tom Chiller of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control about whether that was possible.
Well, it's not only possible. I mean, it's happening. I mean, we see resistance in pretty much everywhere and everything we test. So there is a certain amount of resistance in cattle and pigs and chickens and humans and the retail meat that we buy in stores. Anywhere you use antibiotics, you're going to have resistance and propagate resistance.
So, David, I think few people would disapprove of giving medications to animals that are affected by a disease outbreak. But what sort of justifications come from the industry about simply giving these drugs to make their animals grow bigger and stronger on less feed?
Well, I would agree with you, first of all. We're not talking here about animals with disease. Of course, antibiotics, we have an obligation to the animals and to ourselves to use antibiotics in those situations. But there are two other conditions that have commonly been described as calling for the widespread use of antibiotics for healthy animals, usually in their feed or sometimes in water. And that is to promote growth, as I described, to get the animals to grow bigger on less feed, and also to prevent disease. Now, preventing disease actually sounds like a worthwhile goal, but there is a real question about whether you generate some resistance if you use an antibiotic and give it to an entire herd or flock as a preventative measure. Of course, preventing disease, having healthy animals, is part of our food chain, and it's not necessarily a wrong thing to do. But if the continued low dosing of antibiotics as a preventive measure over years and over a large amount of time creates resistance and resistant bacteria that become a threat to human health, I think some people ask the question about whether prevention is a good use. Now, the Food and Drug Administration has taken this on in the last year or two and taken it on more directly than it had for many years, and has asked the pharmaceutical companies that make these antibiotics to change the label so that they cannot be used any longer for promoting growth. But they will be valid and legal to be used for prevention. But they've added something. They've added a new dimension, which is they've said you can use them for prevention with the supervision of a veterinarian. And I think that's really important. We learned just recently from a report from the FDA that more than 95% of some of these antibiotics are sold over the counter. A veterinarian's not involved. So I think the FDA has made a two-pronged effort here. There's some criticism because the effort to change the label was made in a request to the pharmaceutical companies. They were asked to voluntarily change it. They agreed. It's a phased-in effort over 3 years. They agreed to do that. There's no question that we could have a big debate about whether this was hard and fast enough, but that's where the debate is today.
Is there evidence that the use of those antibiotics in livestock helps prevent foodborne illnesses in people?
Foodborne illness is a related subject, and it's definitely a very interesting one that concerns us. And certainly you want to prevent foodborne illness in all circumstances for human health. And if you have food that is contaminated and that people get ill from it, that's not a good idea. But I'm talking about something slightly different, which is the use of antibiotics routinely in to encourage growth promotion, or even in the use of it for prevention, that will lead to resistance. And that's a real challenge for human health also. And so I think, you know, nobody would like us to go to a time when you can't trust the food supply. We don't want to have food that we can't. We want trustworthy, safe food, and we need healthy animals for that. At the same time, we don't want to get in a situation where we have given so much antibiotics out there that we begin to have bugs that we can't kill at all. That's not good for human health. Just one last thing. Recently, the President's Council of Science Advisors came out with a report, and one of the things they suggested, thinking about the long term here and this trade-off I just mentioned, is that maybe we should develop alternatives to antibiotics in agriculture. And I thought the scientists were telling us that, you know, in the long term, maybe we should rethink some of what we do today, giving so much antibiotics to healthy animals. They called for alternatives. I wonder what those alternatives could be.
Are they talking about things like maybe giving animals more living space or keeping enclosures cleaner, that sort of thing?
You know, this is not my area of expertise, but it's an interesting question that is already beginning to develop some traction in Europe, where in some smaller cases in pilot programs, they're beginning to find ways, for example, with poultry, to cut way down on antibiotics or not use them and control disease through other methods, through methods of the environment. And, you know, again, I don't feel like an expert on this, but I think in the long term, everybody in this country has to ask the question, we have a public health crisis. Antibiotic resistance is upon us. It's a reality. 23,000 Americans die from these resistant infections every year. 2 million are sickened with these infections. Where is it coming from, and what can we do about it?
And as I can imagine many people are sort of feeling growing outrage, it's important to note, as you do in the film, that consumers have benefited from cheaper meat, better quality meat, but there is obviously a cost to this.
And there's a trade-off here that is immutable. You know, evolution doesn't just stop because we said we invented this new antibiotic, so all of you trillions of bacteria just have to stop trying to survive. It's going to go on. And there's no question that even if we did have new antibiotics, resistance would continue to happen. And it's part of the biological world that we live in.
My guest is frontline correspondent David Hoffman. His documentary, The Trouble with Antibiotics, airs tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Frontline correspondent David Hoffman. His documentary, The Trouble with Antibiotics, airs tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, you went to Flagstaff, Arizona, where doctors had noticed a rash of particularly severe urinary tract infections. Can you talk about what researchers started thinking about in deciding to explore the link between those infections and the meat industry?
One of the things that we really have in this modern world that is quite amazing is the ability now to create blueprints of the structure, the genomic structure of a bacteria. And this allows you to compare them, to trace them, to track them. It was played an important role in the film we did last year about the outbreak at the clinical center at the National Institutes of Health, where they also used this technology. And what's happening in Flagstaff was there was this large group of urinary tract infections, and the question became some of them were resistant. Where were these resistant bugs coming from? Where did people get this? And some of the people in Flagstaff told us that these were not the usual patients they saw with this particular infection. These were actually young and pretty healthy people. So the research was designed to take a look at the food supply, at meat, and see if some of these infections were coming from that source. And one of the ways was not just to look at it, you know, eyeball it like you and I would look at the chicken in the market, but to actually test it and to test the meat and the infections, the samples that were kept, and look, using this amazing technology called whole genome sequencing, look for matches, look to see if the food supply, especially the meat supply, was the source of these infections.
So here's evidence that these E. coli, the E. coli in the urinary tract infection, the E. coli in the food, came from the same original E. coli population, so
which
probably
is
the farm.
Probably the farm, but you don't really know how it got there, right? That's a bit of a guess.
When we see this, when we see such genetic relatedness like this, the alternative explanations become, you know, impossible.
So is Lance Price that we heard there, who was the researcher in Flagstaff, Arizona, is he saying that by eating this meat, people can be getting sick?
No, I think what he's saying is he's giving us a peek at research that suggests that these resistant bacteria might be on the meat. And that maybe people have cross-contaminated it, you know, they put it on the countertop, they splattered it, and that maybe that's one way, one route by which some of these resistant pathogens have sickened people. I think there's a difference between that and when you say in the meat, because a lot of times what you worry about is not necessarily eating it, but preparing it.
So in other words, your hands get contaminated and you don't wash them properly, and then you touch part of your body and you can spread the bacteria
that
way.
Or you splatter it on a cutting board that you put the salad on afterwards. There's any number of ways that people in food preparation, if there is some kind of contamination, they can spread it and get sick from it. And, you know, Lance Price's work isn't finished yet. And of course, I want to see the final. He was giving us a peek at something, but the whole genome sequencing provides a pretty close match. I mean, you're looking at essentially the genetic structure of the bacteria, and you're saying this one and this one match. Now, the amounts of them that match, he's not finished yet, but he is dealing with a sample that was more than 1,200 people that had this infection in a relatively small town, Flagstaff, and equally as many samples taken from the meat supply right from supermarkets where people shop for an entire year. So, you know, I think it will be interesting when the research is finished and published and peer-reviewed to see how many matches he gets. And, you know, it's possible that something like this, that these E. coli that are the really bad ones, especially the resistant ones, they could be coming from other sources as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now to Tom in Atlanta. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. This is interesting. You just brought up that point about the E. coli. You know, anecdotally, I've been noticing that children are getting taller, and they're coming from parents that are not as tall. And more and more of these children are eating a lot of fast food. Now, I don't want to slam the fast food industry over with this question here, but is the concern as parents that we're beginning to have are these bacteria and or hormones or whatever, but coming through the meat supply, getting to our children? Because you said that this bacteria helps the cattle grow, isn't it? Not could it not be helping the children grow?
Well, the antibiotics help the cattle grow, not the bacteria.
Thank you for correcting me.
Sure. Yes. Thanks for your question. What do you know about that, David?
Well, I don't know everything about that, but there is a very interesting emerging train of research and thought that a lot of the growth patterns that we have as people are governed by and influenced by the bacteria in our gut, and that if we use antibiotics or overuse them, even with children, if we overuse them, that we change the microbial nature of our gut. It's called the microbiome, and that can influence whether children become tall or obese. I'm not so sure about tall, but certainly there's been a discussion about whether this is a thing that leads to obesity.
One idea for avoiding bacteria resistant to powerful antibiotics used in humans was to use old school drugs on animals, things like tetracycline and penicillin. But there was a really interesting experiment that did not turn out the way researchers had imagined it would.
Yes, and you know this antibiotic called tetracycline is quite old. It's decades old, and it is in very wide use today in American agriculture. The Food and Drug Administration says it's about 40% of the antibiotics used on farm animals today. So it's worth asking the question, what is the impact of this? And this particular experiment, which I found quite interesting, tried to essentially answer the question, if you used a little more tetracycline and not another more modern, shall we say, later generation antibiotic, you know, could you essentially save that more modern antibiotic perhaps for more urgent uses for people? And when the researchers carried out this experiment, it was complex, but it quite clearly showed a phenomenon that's called co-selection. And it suggests that when you use even an older antibiotic, like tetracycline, it can create resistance. It can create resistance by the bacteria not only to tetracycline, but to other antibiotics as well. In this case, it created resistance to an antibiotic that is more modern, that's highly valued and used in human medicine, called cephalosporin, or that's the name of the class of antibiotic that's used. And so it raises the question, why is that happening? And I think we're still learning a lot about the genetic makeup of bacteria and how they behave and how they evolve. But I think this experiment hints at this idea that actually the bacteria carry some of the genes for this resistance around with them. They swap these genes, this information about how to resist antibiotics. And it's not so clear cut that if you just use the old one, the tetracyclines, that you'll be home clear with the ones that are more valuable to human medicine, the more modern ones.
One thing that makes it hard to study this issue is the fact that there are not requirements for farmers to report exactly how much antibiotic they use or how they use it in what applications. Can you talk about that?
I was really surprised to find out how little information there is about this. You can go around and try and find official sources and ask, for example, how much and what kind of antibiotics are we using in this country on turkeys or on swine, and you can't find official data. There's very, very little. We have data about the sales of antibiotics broadly. We know which types, and the FDA published its new information about this just recently. But even if you read the FDA report, it says, you know, we have very limited information. Here it is. Here are the types. Here's the amount in sales. But how can we understand the impact of this, and how can we even begin to study resistance if we can't get a little deeper and understand which animals are getting which antibiotics?
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, many times it seems that we find ways in our economy to boost profitability and supply through unvetted processes. Once major problems are brought to the attention of the public, we're told we cannot simply shift our ways away from what has worked for the suppliers while harming us at the same time. What does it take to find a balance between change and the livelihood of farmers and ranchers?
Well, I think the first thing it takes is a discussion. And I point out in the film that this subject of whether or not animals and man exist in the same ecosystem and whether or not resistance can move back and forth between them, this subject was raised in early 1977 by a commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, a Stanford biologist named Donald Kennedy, who had just been appointed. And it was one of the first things he raised. And, you know, I think 40 years, that's a long time. And as to your questioner's point, one way to get to a balance is to have a debate about it.
Are there what kind of lobby does the pharmaceutical industry have that protects the ability of farmers to continue dosing their animals these ways?
Well, the animal drug makers and the various lobbyists for various farm groups have made no secret about their support for the use of these antibiotics on farm animals for decades. And when that commissioner of Food and Drug in 1977, Dr. Kennedy, tried to raise questions about it, they sent hundreds and hundreds of letters to the FDA from all around the country, from every farm bureau, from every sector, saying, you know, you can't do this. This will be ruin us. This will just completely wreck our business. We can't do this. And to be honest with you, Dr. Kennedy, you know, the outcry was so great, it reached the Congress, and members of Congress went to him and says, you can't do this. And he had to back down. The changes he proposed were never implemented. And 38 years went by, and here we are. And antibiotics are still being used for healthy farm animals. Now, as I mentioned, the FDA has begun some steps to change that. They asked the drug makers to voluntarily make a change, and the drug makers all agreed. But one of the real questions that come out of this is, will this lead to less antibiotics being used on the farm, or will it just lead to a different label? Are we going to really stop using them for promoting growth and just call it prevention? Or will these new efforts to put veterinarians in charge and change the label lead to real reductions? Because when you think about it, from the bacteria point of view, right, they're involved in this fight for survival. And if an antibiotic comes in and says, oh, I'm just here for prevention, that doesn't mean anything to the bacteria. You know, one way or the other, we have this process of resistance, and we have a human health, public health problem with resistance. And this is something that now the top scientists in the country have told the president. What are we going to do about it? And I think the answer is not only to look at the abuses in human medicine, they're big, they're serious, they're problematic, but also to look at what extent is resistance coming from the farm.
Scientists are also trying to understand why people who live near farms but may not work on them also seem to have higher rates of antibiotic-resistant infections. What are some of the theories that might explain this phenomenon?
You know, in the film, we talked to some researchers who were studying this, and they were looking at a particular kind of infection called MRSA or MRSA, and the incidence of it in people that live near large swine feeding operations. And I think one of the interesting things about that study is it also raises the question you raised earlier about how can humans get sick with these resistant organisms. And in this particular case, one of the researchers pointed out that in central Pennsylvania, where the study was conducted, hundreds of millions of pounds of gallons of manure were spread on crop fields for fertilizer. And as you spread this manure, it has resistant bacteria in it. It has residual antibiotics in it. You know, so as you spread it, then what happens on a dry day when the wind picks up, or on a really rainy day when the streams are flooded with the runoff? And this raises an interesting question about whether the problem of resistance is not only a problem that has very specialized pathways, like you go to a hospital and you pick up this bug and you get sick, but also maybe it's an environmental pathway. In other words, it's out there in the environment. And just like other things we worry about in the environment, maybe resistance is something that we're spreading that way.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bill. Hello, Bill. Bill has hung up the phone. All right.
I answered that question.
You did brilliantly on that one. We did have an email here from S. Taylor, who says, we've been Stoker cattle owners for 8 years now. We buy calves between 200 and 250 pounds. In our experience, we lose about 25 to 30% of the heads if we don't give one dose of antibiotics after purchase. We'd like to be able to avoid it, but are there other alternatives? I mean, is this something farmers are struggling with? If everyone else is doing this and they're experiencing losses, that's just not financially viable, right?
And I also think that agriculture as a whole needs to also engage in a discussion. This issue became very polarized. It became very much, you know, one side and the other side fighting back and forth. And I think that what really farmers and ranchers ought to be doing is saying, look, we no longer should just be in denial about this problem. There is a resistance problem in human health, and we ought to face it and think about what the alternatives might be. It may take a while to get to alternatives, but better to face it head on and to think about creative ways to do something than to just say it's not a problem. And to be honest with you, if you look at the record for many, many years, people in agriculture were saying, we are not the main source of the resistance problem. It's doctors, it's hospitals, it's human health. Don't blame agriculture. But my research suggests that that is just putting your head in the sand. The resistance problem is growing. We have to look at all the reasons for it.
Journalist David Hoffman is with us. He's a correspondent for Frontline. Its documentary, The Trouble with Antibiotics, airs tomorrow at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll pick up our conversation in just a couple of minutes here. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Frontline correspondent David Hoffman about the program The Trouble with Antibiotics that will air on Frontline tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, I want to talk about the challenges that hospitals face in preventing the spread of infections among vulnerable populations. Of course, this is top of mind in North Texas because we have the transmission of a viral illness. You've heard the story of Ebola that we're facing here. We're talking about bacteria in this film, but you do include a very chilling account of a few years ago, of all places, the National Institute of Health Hospital in Annapolis, Maryland.
And I've been following the Ebola crisis very closely, and I think that all of us have had our eyes opened about the potential dangers to human health from bacteria and viruses. This hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, the Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health, is a research hospital. Patients are invited there for research. It's really high quality. It's the best of the best. And they had an outbreak of an antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the summer of 2011. The outbreak continued for 6 months until December. And 18 patients were infected, and six of them died. Now, they thought in December of that year they had gotten past the worst of it. They had taken extraordinary measures, cleaning, sending robots in to, you know, spray disinfectant, walling off part of the intensive care unit. They had really taken heroic efforts to try and stop it, and they thought they had. And 6 months later, a young man was back, was there. He had been there before, but he had come back for a bone marrow transplant. Obviously, this is a young man who was ill, and he had come to this hospital because they had a research reason for also wanting to treat him. And why he was there, this antibiotic-resistant bacteria that the hospital thought was gone resurfaced, and he caught it, and he died from it, not from the bone marrow transplant. And, of course, this was a very sad story, but one of the things that it reminds us is how prevalent some of these bacteria and viruses can be. This particular one was probably brought back into the hospital by one of the other patients, one of the 18 patients who had come back in for an outpatient visit. And it just makes you realize we live in a world that's full of these kinds of threats. And oftentimes, you know, we take our health for granted and we take for granted that we live in a society where this kind of thing can't happen. But hospitals especially, where, as you mentioned, there are vulnerable people, can be reservoirs of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They can live on sinks. They can at least stick around for a while on a doorknob or a handrail. And they can persist and multiply and move from patients to patients. In this particular outbreak in Bethesda at the clinical center, there were people who were found to be carrying the particular bacteria without showing symptoms. They were silent carriers. And if they came in touch, in contact with somebody else, they may have spread it to somebody else who wasn't so silent, who got sick. And, you know, I don't think that all of the incredible fear about Ebola is justified. I think some ways we've overreacted to what's happened to us here in the United States. But boy, when you see what happened in Africa to a place where people were unprepared, you begin to realize what an enormous threat this can be to all of us. And I think, you know, it's going to require some effort.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Carol in McKinney. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I just wondered how they're handling this type of antibiotic resistance, or are they having the same problem we are in Europe and in the EU, or how do they handle it as far as the food that they grow?
The Europeans have a different kind of a healthcare system. So one of the things that you can see right away is that they were tracking the nature and the rise of antibiotic resistance with much more precision than we were, partly because they have a more centralized system. The state has a much bigger role in healthcare in Europe. So they saw the information. They had much more precise information about it years ago. And then they began, in some cases, mostly smaller cases like Denmark, to take action to try and cut back the amount of antibiotics given to farm animals. And they've had some mixed results with it. I'm not an expert on this, but it seems clear to me that their thinking is ahead of our thinking about how to do this, that their experimentation with different methods or with cutting back is ahead of ours. But it's also true that, you know, if you cut back on the use of antibiotics, you may have more diseased animals. And then you may need more antibiotics to take care of those diseased animals. Now, that's not an ironclad rule. It's not necessarily a permanent thing. But that indicates, I think, how difficult this whole problem is.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
How are you doing? I just wanted to comment. I'm a personal injury attorney here in Dallas. I was born and raised on a dairy farm in northeast Texas, and there were thousands of dairy farms. We milked about 120 cows. We had friends from the Netherlands that were milking 800 cows, and I have never seen one dairy farm ever give antibiotics to increase the amount of milk to a dairy cow because of the profit margins. And you made a comment with regard to MRSA. I've had clients in the Dallas Metroplex that have had contracted MRSA from having a simple ACL or PCL surgery. that were nowhere were they living around any type of hog farms or any type of swine. They caught a bacterial resistant, you know, just from a simple surgery. So I think a lot of I'm just saying, I've never seen any dairy farm ever give antibiotics to a cow to increase milk because the profit margins are not there.
Well, Bill, thanks for your call. And I'm sure that David and the film do not mean to imply that MRSA comes
only from...
We're not
talking about dairy.
Right.
We're not talking about dairy.
And you're talking about animals produced for meat in this film.
Yes.
Okay.
And on the question of MRSA, I mean, yes. You know, there are serious cases of MRSA that high school footballers get because they get a scrape on the field, you know. You see this around the country all the time and football locker rooms. You can get it lots of different ways.
Does the study of organic farms provide any insight into what happens when you either limit or eliminate the use of antibiotics in animals?
You know, we didn't go there because this is a food safety issue again.
Yeah.
I think it's an important one, and I'm very interested in it. But I think that you have a lot of misunderstanding among consumers about what does organic meat mean when they see it on the label at the mm-hmm. grocery store. And even I'm confused sometimes, you know. And I also feel that there are people that want to just get rid of all antibiotics everywhere. Well, I'm not coming from that point of view. They have their purpose. We didn't call them miracle drugs for nothing. I'm coming from a point of view of let's be good stewards. Let's take care of this resource that we have, right, these effective drugs, and not waste it.
So what other potential regulations are on the horizon that might make a difference with this issue?
Well, there isn't much. I think that the Food and Drug Administration has taken this effort now to get the labels changed and to say to all the farmers and ranchers in the United States, you can use these valuable drugs for something called prevention with a veterinarian. And we don't have any clue right now about how that's going to work out. And because there is not a lot of data on antibiotics, we're not even sure we're going to be able to tell right away how much antibiotic use changes. But that is the first real effort by the FDA to do something since 1977. And again, I know that there's a big debate. There are a lot of people saying, oh, they should do more. You know, they should ban the use of antibiotics on the farm, or no, they shouldn't ban them. But the fact is that that's what's happening right now. And the manufacturers have said we'll at least change the label. This puts a big burden on veterinarians all around the country because, as I mentioned, some 95% of these drugs are now sold right over the counter. So that's the first thing. The second question is, we need new antibiotics. We need to stimulate the discovery of them, especially for human health. And that's a different issue because those drugs have a long, difficult approval process through the federal government, largely through the FDA. And that process is expensive. And a lot of the drug makers have said, we're not going to invest in research in new antibiotics because the profit margins are so small. The return on investment doesn't justify it. We'd rather invest in some new blockbuster drug like Lipitor or Viagra or something. And as a result, this research, this vital research that's important to all of us who go to the hospital or get a scratch on our knee or whatever, the drugs pipeline is dried up. It's really almost down to no new antibiotics every year, maybe one or two, with the exception of a few small biotechnology companies. And that's a worrisome thing. You asked me about what new regulations are, but this is a worrisome political and economic problem. Should we change the regulatory approach? How do we stimulate drug companies to go out and find new antibiotics? I don't think anyone has the answer yet.
Back to the phones now. Let's speak this time with Sharon in Austin. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very intrigued by this conversation. I'm looking forward to watching the show when I have time. And I come from our family. I have children, and I'm married, and we don't use antibiotics in our home. I know we're talking about the food that we eat. We don't buy any they're treated with antibiotics either. We've been doing this over the last 8 years. We've been enlightened by films such as Food Matters and Food Incorporated. And our health has improved tremendously. And along the journey, which began with my mother having breast cancer, we went down a different path than most people. And we decided that we would heal our bodies naturally and through food.
Do you think this is something that a lot more people, David, are going to be thinking about? And did you, it's not specifically part of the film, but are Americans in general starting to question the use of the medications they use for themselves?
Well, I think that I can't really comment on the caller's particular preferences, but I would say antibiotics are miracle drugs. They have saved millions of lives. They make things like transplants possible in modern medicine. I think they're extremely valuable and important. And I think that our challenge as a society is find out how do we keep that going? How do we not lose that? The president's science advisor said that resistance is outpacing the antibiotics that we have. The bugs are beating us in this race. And so I think as a public health matter, when we think about what's happened with Ebola, which is in our headlines, or antibiotic resistance, or some of the other really serious public health problems we face in the country, we should be very realistic and very sober and straightforward and think, how do we cope with that? And in the case of resistance, we know it's driven by the use of these antibiotics and the abuse of them. So I'm hoping people begin to get away a little bit from the idea that there's a magic bullet here. Public health is complex. We're a society. We have an open, free market system where we have companies that do drug development. We also have a very decentralized health system. We have private and public parts of it. It's not always easy to face something like a problem. But when the president's science advisors say, this brewing problem has become a crisis, I'm quoting from their report 4 weeks ago, I think we ought to listen.
It's terrifying to think that there's a possibility that antibiotics would be a miracle for a century of human history and then go away.
Yes, but what if it was true? Hmm. What if they just stopped working because we abused them and overused them and didn't have a replacement? What if something like a strep throat could turn into a killer? What if you had a relative go in for minor surgery and there was an infection and that person died? That happened once in our history. Maybe people don't remember it today. You know, there are not protests and people marching in the streets saying, save antibiotics. And that's what worries me, is that it's not a high enough priority. Not enough attention has been paid to this resistance problem. It's slowly creeping up on us. But believe me, more people will be hurt this year by antibiotic-resistant infections than will be hurt by Ebola.
Journalist period. David Hoffman is a correspondent for Frontline. The episode titled The Trouble with Antibiotics airs tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. David, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.